February 2nd, 2008, Saanich, British Columbia. 24-year-old real estate agent Lindsay Buziak arrives for an appointment to show an expensive suburban house to an unidentified man and woman. When Lindsay's boyfriend goes inside the residence to check on her, he discovers that she has been stabbed over 40 times, and the mysterious couple have fled the scene. Over the years, there are a number of unconfirmed theories surrounding Lindsay's murder, such as her death being connected to a massive drug bust, but the crime continues to remain unsolved. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering one of our most highly requested cases, the 2008 murder of Lindsay Buziak. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Melissa Holman, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Melissa. This has been a recurring monthly contest which we've been carrying on for over 5 years now, so if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, the murder of Lindsay Buziak was the case Melissa requested that I cover when she originally entered the contest, and the timing couldn't be better, because the date of this episode's release is just one day shy of the 15th anniversary of this crime. This is one of the more famous unsolved cold cases from our podcast's home country of Canada, so much so that it has received widespread coverage on such American true crime shows like Dateline. And needless to say, this story turned out to be a much bigger rabbit hole than I was anticipating. Lindsay Buziak was a real estate agent who made arrangements to show an expensive house that was up for sale to some prospective clients, but she wound up being stabbed to death in the master bedroom. Eyewitnesses reported seeing Lindsay with a man and woman before she entered the house, and while these two individuals have never been identified, another big unanswered question in this case is whether someone hired these people to kill Lindsay. There has been no shortage of theories surrounding this crime, such as Lindsay's death somehow being connected to a drug bust which took place during that time period. Suspicion has also been pointed at the family of Lindsay's boyfriend, Jason Zalo, as Jason showed up at the house right after Lindsay was murdered and discovered her body. In fact, one of the most controversial elements of this case is that even though police have publicly announced that the Zalo family were cleared as suspects, a number of people question that decision and still believe the Zalos were somehow involved in the murder. Now, this has turned out to be one of the most challenging cold cases I've ever had to research, as there is a lot of contradictory information out there from different sources, and it can be quite difficult to separate fact from fiction. Lindsay's father, Jeff Buziak, has been a very strong advocate who has fought diligently to keep her case in the spotlight, and he maintains a website containing a ton of information and theories about what may have happened, but many of these details have never been officially corroborated by the media or law enforcement. So throughout the course of this episode, I'll frequently be listing the sources of some of the details I share, and addressing any instances in which there is contradictory information, as I want to try and create the most fair, objective, and unbiased account of this case as I can. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the murder of Lindsay Buziak. Our story begins in British Columbia in 2008, and our central figure is 24-year-old Lindsay Buziak, who lives in the province's capital city of Victoria, located on the southern tip of Vancouver Island. Lindsay's parents are Jeff Buziak and Evelyn Reitmeyer, and she also has a younger sister named Sarah. Since Jeff and Evelyn have divorced, Jeff has moved to Calgary, Alberta, though he maintains a very close relationship with his daughters. Jeff is also a successful real estate agent, so Lindsay has decided to start her own career in that field and currently works for the Remax Camison Agency in Victoria. The office just happens to be managed by Shirley Zalo, the mother of Lindsay's boyfriend, Jason Zalo. After originally meeting at a real estate tutoring course, Lindsay and Jason have been a couple for just over a year and are living together in a condo, and Jason also works as a mortgage broker. On January the 31st, Lindsay received a call on her cell phone from a woman who said that her husband had just been transferred to Victoria and they were urgently looking for a large home to buy. She said that they needed to make the purchase within the next 3 days and were looking for something in the price range of $1 million. The woman listed off some specifications for the type of home she was looking for, which included 3 bathrooms and 3 bedrooms with a large master bedroom, and also a separate living area for a maid. Lindsay would describe the woman as having a quote-unquote strong Spanish or Mexican accent, and she apparently told people that she thought the accent might be fake. Lindsay asked the woman how she got her cell phone number, as she was still fairly new to the real estate business at that point, but the woman said Lindsay had been recommended to her by a previous client. Lindsay took down this woman's number and said she would get back to her, but the story goes that when Lindsay attempted to contact this previous client to verify the woman's story, she found out they were out of town and never got the chance to speak with them. Lindsay never wrote down or told anyone the names of this mysterious woman or her husband, and in conversations, she only referred to them as the Mexicans or under the nickname Million Dollar. Needless to say, Lindsay had some concerns about the situation, as it seemed too good to be true. But if these clients were legitimate, and Lindsay sold them a home in the $1 million price range, she would get a huge commission out of the deal. Over the next 2 days, Lindsay had 10 more phone conversations with these clients, and finally made arrangements to show them an expensive house in the district municipality of Saanich, an upscale suburb which is a part of the Greater Victoria area. The residence was located in the Gordon Head neighborhood at 1702 D'Souza Place, a newly developed cul-de-sac containing a private subdivision of homes. The house's list price was $964,900, and Lindsay arranged to meet the woman and her husband there for a private showing on Saturday, February the 2nd at 5:30 p.m. It's been reported that at one point, Lindsay received a call from the husband, who told her that his wife was feeling ill and that he would attend the showing alone, but as we're going to discuss momentarily, it doesn't look like this happened. So now we're going to talk about one of our first examples of contradictory information in this case. Most sources will tell you that Lindsay was apprehensive about the showing, so Jason offered to drive there and wait outside the property in his vehicle so he could keep an eye on her. Well, in October of 2020, a Victoria-based newspaper called the Capital Daily published an extensive new article about this case written by investigative reporter Xander Sherman. Sherman and a team of journalists had spent an entire year performing their own investigation into the murder, which involved interviewing dozens of people and obtaining over 1,000 emails. They also petitioned the British Columbia Supreme Court to unseal a number of documents related to the case, which had never been released publicly before. The court agreed to the request, and even though many of these documents were heavily redacted, they still contain some new pieces of information which I'll be talking about in more detail later on. Anyway, when the Capital Daily published their article, their account of Lindsay and Jason's interactions before the showing is a bit different than what you'll find from most other sources, so I'll be addressing this as we go along. According to the article, on the night before the showing, Jason attempted to quell Lindsay's concerns by proposing the idea of showing the house on her behalf, as Lindsay was also hoping to attend a friend's bachelorette party later that night. But Lindsay turned his offer down because she always liked to take care of things on her own. Sometime on the afternoon of February the 2nd, Lindsay stopped by the Remax office, and the receptionist would later say that she was feeling quote-unquote really weird and freaked out about the showing. Shortly thereafter, Lindsay met Jason for a late lunch at a local restaurant named Sauce, and the article says that Jason once again proposed the idea of doing the showing for her, but she declined. Shortly before 4:30 p.m., they went their separate ways, as Lindsay went home to change clothes, and Jason drove to a nearby auto shop called SHC Autographs, as the owners had apparently hired Lindsay to help sell a property, and Jason was going to present them an offer on her behalf. While Jason was there, Lindsay called him on his cell phone to let him know she was heading to D'Souza Place for the showing, and Jason offered to meet her there in order to give her some paperwork from the auto shop owners which may have needed her signature. According to the Capital Daily article, this is when Jason first proposed the idea of waiting outside the house in his vehicle to keep an eye on her, and Lindsay agreed to this, even though she still wanted to do the showing on her own. Shortly thereafter, Jason received a call on his cell phone from a friend of his named Cohen Oatman, whom he was planning to meet for dinner. This is where Jason may have told Cohen about his plans to go to D'Souza Place to check on Lindsay, so Cohen agreed to meet Jason at the auto shop, leave his own car in the parking lot there, and they would both leave together in Jason's Range Rover. After Jason and Cohen met up, Jason had trouble finding the resident's address in his vehicle's navigation system, so he called Lindsay at 5:30 to ask for directions. At this point, Lindsay told Jason that the buyers had arrived, so she had to go, but she would text him the address. After Jason received it, he texted Lindsay back to let her know he would be arriving in 10 to 15 minutes, and she responded by texting that she would see him in a bit. It's been reported in some places that Jason called his brother Ryan in order to get the directions, but this detail is not mentioned in the Capital Daily article. At 5:38, while Jason was driving, he texted Lindsay again to let her know he was a couple minutes away, but she never replied, and it would later turn out that this message was not even opened. Jason finally arrived at D'Souza Place at 5:45, but Lindsay was not outside, and even though her BMW was parked in the driveway, no other vehicles were at the scene. So here we've got yet another example of contradictory information from different sources. If you've watched the Dateline episode about this case, they say that when Jason arrived, he claimed he could see the outline of what appeared to be a male figure moving inside the house through the smoked glass on the front door. And depending on which source you read, it's also been reported that he saw multiple figures in the residence. However, there are other sources, such as an episode of the show True Crime Daily, which state that one or more figures were in the midst of leaving the house when Jason arrived, before they quickly went back inside and closed the door. Either way, Jason just assumed that these were the buyers, and Lindsay was giving them a tour of the house, so he parked outside. But since Jason wanted to come across as a quote-unquote meddling boyfriend, he eventually decided to drive his Range Rover out of the cul-de-sac and turn the corner to park on the adjacent Torquay Drive. After waiting about 10 minutes, Jason had still not heard from Lindsay, so he tried calling her cell phone and sent her another text message to ask how she was doing, but she never responded. Jason finally became concerned enough that he and Cohen both exited the Range Rover and walked up to the house, but they discovered that the front door was locked. Since he worked in real estate himself, Jason found this very unusual, since it was standard practice for the front door to be left unlocked during house showings. Even though he repeatedly knocked on the door and rang the doorbell, there was no answer. When Jason looked through the window, he noticed Lindsay's high-heeled shoes in the foyer, as it's common practice for real estate agents and potential buyers to remove their footwear when they enter a house for a showing. Jason became concerned enough to contact his mother and asked if she could help put him in touch with the house's listing agent, as he hoped that the agent might be able to give him the passcode for the garage. Jason apparently got the agent's information and tried to contact them without success, so at 6:05 p.m., he called 911 and explained the whole situation to the operator. After walking to the side of the house, Jason noticed that the back door, which was next to an enclosed patio, just happened to be open. So Jason gave Cohen a boost over the fence and asked him to enter the house through the back door. Jason then ran back to the front door while Cohen unlocked it from the inside and let him in the house. Jason then ran upstairs into the master bedroom and discovered Lindsay's body lying on the floor in a pool of blood. She had been stabbed over 40 times, mostly in the head and chest. While law enforcement has never publicly confirmed this, One detail which has frequently been shared about this crime is that Lindsay received a lot of stab wounds in her breasts, where she had recently received augmentation surgery. Jason summoned Cohen to the bedroom, and after he saw Lindsay, Cohen proceeded to call 911 at 6:11 p.m., while Jason checked Lindsay's body and attempted to perform CPR. After police and paramedics arrived at the scene, Lindsay was pronounced dead, and since there were no signs of defensive wounds on Lindsay's body, it appeared that she was taken by complete surprise and attacked from behind. It does not sound like the murder weapon was found, and while it has been reported that there were bloody footprints at the scene, there have been conflicting accounts about whether or not there was any DNA, fingerprints, or hair or fiber evidence which might have belonged to the killer. Lindsay was not sexually assaulted, and none of her possessions have been stolen to indicate robbery, so at first, no one could figure out the motive for this crime. Jason and Cohen were taken into custody by the Saanich Police Department for questioning, and Jason would later return to the house with them to film a reenactment video in which he recounted the circumstances of how he found Jason's body. It appeared that Jason's story did check out, as surveillance footage from SHC Autographs showed him and Cohen leaving there together at 5:30 p.m. Jason's account of his communications with Lindsay was also backed up by phone records, and footprint and fingerprint evidence supported Jason and Cohen's story about how they entered the house. The Saanich PD would interview Jason numerous times and said that he was always cooperative and passed a polygraph test. About a year after the murder, the police publicly announced that they had cleared Jason as a suspect. The residence contained an electronic real estate lockbox next to the front door, and electronic records would show that Lindsay had accessed it to retrieve the key at 5:29. A pair of eyewitnesses also reported seeing Lindsay meeting up with a man and a woman outside the house sometime between 5:30 and 5:40 p.m. They reportedly shook hands with Lindsay, and judging from their body language, the witnesses got the impression that Lindsay did not know them and was meeting them for the first time. The man was described as being Caucasian, 6 feet tall, and having dark hair, and wearing a light to medium colored jacket. The woman was also described as being Caucasian, between 35 and 45 years old, having short blonde hair, and wearing what was described as a distinct black dress patterned with white and red swirls. Composite sketches would be created for these two individuals, though police would not circulate them publicly until a year after the murder. It seemed likely that after Lindsay brought the man and woman inside to give them a tour of the house, they wound up killing her inside the master bedroom. It turned out that a call had been made from Lindsay's BlackBerry at 5:41 p.m., and it wound up going to the voicemail of a friend she hadn't spoken to in a while. Nothing but muffling sounds could be heard on the message, but since Lindsay's BlackBerry was found inside her pocket, it was theorized that the call had been dialed accidentally while Lindsay was being attacked. Since Jason reported seeing one or more figures at the front door when he arrived at 5:45, it's possible that the perpetrators were in the midst of leaving the house, but decided to go back inside when they saw Jason's Range Rover pull up. They then decided to escape through the back patio door, which would explain why it was left open. There was also a gap in the back fence next to the enclosed patio, as some boards were missing, so the killers may have slipped through the gap to escape. Neither Jason nor the other witnesses reported seeing any other vehicles besides Lindsay's BMW at the house, so it's possible that the man and woman parked their own vehicle on an adjacent road, such as Torquay Drive. They then proceeded to walk to the house and then walk back to the getaway vehicle when they ran outside and made their escape. Lindsay had written down the phone number of the prospective buyer in her day planner, and investigators tracked it to a cell phone which had been purchased at a convenience store in Vancouver in late November of 2007. But of course, since 2 months had already passed, security camera footage of the individual who bought the phone was no longer available. The device turned out to be a prepaid burner phone which had been activated and registered over the internet on January the 31st, 2008, 2 days before Lindsay was killed. It was registered under the name Paulo Rodriguez, as well as an address in Vancouver. Investigators concluded that Paulo Rodriguez was likely a fake name, and while the address was matched to a legitimate business, it did not appear to have any connection to the crime and may have been chosen at random. The only incoming and outgoing calls from the burner phone were made to Lindsay's cell phone, and since it was deactivated shortly after the murder, it appeared that the phone was used for the express purpose of orchestrating the crime. Cell tower ping records showed that the phone was on a ferry which traveled from Vancouver to Victoria on the day before Lindsay was killed. Lindsay's father, Jeff Buziak, would soon become a major advocate for his daughter and has spent the past 15 years seeking justice for Lindsay's murder. Jeff has claimed that when he first viewed Lindsay's body in the morgue, he stroked her hair and told her, quote, "I'm going to find out who did this to you, or I will die trying." While speaking at Lindsay's funeral, Jeff stated, quote, "If there's anyone here who had anything to do with this horrible act, please come up to the front right now. This will be your only chance of forgiveness," end quote. Lindsay's mother, Evelyn Reitmeier, has mostly shied away from the spotlight, but in February of 2010, on the two-year anniversary of the crime, Evelyn made her first public statement at a press conference when she announced that her family, the Greater Victoria Real Estate Board, and the Canadian Real Estate Association were all putting up a $100,000 reward for information which led to the arrest and conviction of a suspect. The reward would only be offered for 6 months in order to encourage individuals to come forward as quickly as possible, but it did not lead to any major developments, and the reward offer was not renewed once the deadline passed. However, in September of that year, Lindsay's murder would receive international coverage when it was the subject of an episode of the popular American true crime show Dateline titled Dreamhouse Mystery. Interviewees on the show included Jeff Buziak, Lindsay's best friend Nikki Burrows, and Lindsay's former boyfriend Matt McDuff, who had been in a 5-year relationship with her before they broke up in 2006. Jason and Shirley Zalo were also interviewed, marking the first time they had agreed to sit down together and speak to the media about the case. According to Jeff and Nikki, Lindsay had told her friends and family that her relationship with Jason wasn't working because he was frequently jealous, demanding, and overprotective. In fact, she was considering breaking up with him and even quitting her job at Shirley's RE/MAX office, but wanted to wait until some of the real estate deals she was working on were closed. However, between Christmas and New Year's in 2007, Jason went on a ski trip with the Zalo family and was reportedly reconsidering breaking up with Jason, and for his part, Jason denied that there were any serious issues with the relationship. During the Dateline episode, Shirley claimed that on the day before Lindsay was killed, they took a walk together, and Lindsay told her that she was afraid of her ex-boyfriend, Matt. While Matt maintained that he had not even been in contact with Lindsay for months prior to her death, and also denied any involvement in her murder. On the day of the crime, Matt had an alibi placing him an hour away from Saanich, as he was with the family of his current girlfriend, whom he later married, and investigators have never considered him to be a suspect. While the Dateline episode helped bring in some new tips to law enforcement, it did not lead them any closer to a resolution. But shortly after the episode aired, the Saanich PD publicly announced that the Zalo family, including Jason, Shirley, and her other son Ryan, had all been cleared as suspects. Investigators stated that they were satisfied that the Zalos had nothing to do with the murder and wanted to end the quote-unquote finger-pointing, rumor, speculation, and innuendo. Even though Lindsay's murder resembled a professional hit, investigators thoroughly checked into her background and financial records and found nothing to indicate that she was involved in drugs or criminal activity. So they started exploring the possibility that Lindsay was targeted because false information had spread about her. In December of 2007, Lindsay went on a trip to Calgary to visit her father and used this opportunity to try and reconnect with an old friend she had grown up with who was now living there. It's unclear if Lindsay actually saw this person, but 1 month later, on January the 22nd, 2008, the Calgary Police Service arrested two men on the charge of cocaine possession for the purpose of trafficking. One of these men was Erickson Lopez del Alcazar, who happened to be a relative of Lindsay's friend, and this only turned out to be the tip of the iceberg in a massive police investigation titled Operation High Noon, which involved a criminal network that transported cocaine from British Columbia to Alberta. Over 1 year later, in June of 2009, the Calgary Police Service concluded this operation by making the largest cocaine bust in the history of Alberta, as they seized 80 kilos of cocaine worth over $8 million, $330,000 in cash, and a cache of weapons. Del Alcazar was a member of this network, and a total of 14 people were arrested. While Lindsay's murder took place only 11 days after Dalalkazar's arrest, leading to speculation that the two events might have been connected. It's been reported that other people involved in this drug trafficking network tried to find out who ratted Dalalkazar to the authorities and came to believe that Lindsay may have been a police informant who gave him up. While the Saanich PD have ruled out this possibility, maintaining that Lindsay was not a police informant, but have not ruled out the possibility that she may have unknowingly seen or heard something she wasn't supposed to, which put her life in danger. Well, as the years have gone on, and Lindsay's murder has continued to remain unsolved, Jeff Buziak has taken steps to ensure that her case remains in the spotlight and performed his own independent investigation. Every year on the anniversary of Lindsay's death, he has held an annual memorial walk for justice, which begins at Royal Oak Burial Park, the cemetery in Victoria where Lindsay's ashes are interred. The walk goes through the Gore and Head neighborhood, past the house on D'Souza Place where Lindsay was murdered, and ends on the steps of Saanich Municipal Hall. Jeff has done a number of media interviews, including an appearance on the Dr. Phil show, where he has openly expressed his frustration with the Saanich PD's inability to solve this case. Even though the Zalo family were cleared as suspects, Jeff has still continued to publicly share his suspicions about them and their possible involvement in the murder. During the past several years, he has maintained a website about the case at lindsaybuziakmurder.wordpress.com. In August of 2017, an anonymous poster left a comment on the website containing the sentence, quote, "I killed Lindsay, and the cops will never prove it, so you all got nothing," end quote. The comment was filled with insults towards Jeff, the Saanich PD, and Lindsay's girlfriends, though there were questions about the writer's credibility, since they misspelled Lindsay's name with an E rather than an A. Regardless, the commenter did not share any specific details to suggest they had inside knowledge of the crime. Like I mentioned earlier on in the episode, in October of 2020, the Capital Daily published an extensive article about the case after receiving some newly unsealed police documents containing information which had never been released publicly. One detail from these documents which I have not yet mentioned is that a second cell phone, which the police referred to as a quote-unquote second crime phone, was used in the commission of the murder. We know that the burner phone that the killer used to communicate with Lindsay was purchased in Vancouver, but this second crime phone was used to check the voicemail messages on the first phone. Most interestingly, the article implied that the Saanich PD knew the identity of the person who purchased the two phones, though investigators have never publicly confirmed or denied this. The article also revealed that when the Saanich PD examined Lindsay's laptop computer, they noticed some missing chat messages, though they could not determine when exactly they had been deleted. And even though Lindsay was known for being very active on Facebook, a check of her account revealed that there were no messages left on her Facebook wall from any of her 700 friends in between January the 24th and February the 3rd of 2008. While investigators have never publicly confirmed this, there has been speculation that there may have been some messages left on her wall that were deleted, and she also had individuals on her Facebook friends list who were known for violent criminal activity and being involved in the distribution of illegal drugs. In February of 2021, the Saanich PD announced that the FBI was now assisting them with the investigation and that advancements in DNA technology and other technology had helped create new leads in the case, though they provided no specific detail. In April of 2022, it was announced that Shirley Zalo had filed a civil complaint in BC Supreme Court against Jeff Buziak and two other defendants. Shirley alleged that while using pseudonyms, these two individuals had left over a dozen comments at Jeff's website falsely accusing her of murder. Shirley, Jason, and Ryan Zalo all spoke to the Capital Daily about the lawsuit, which marked the first time that Shirley and Jason had granted interviews to the media since their appearance on Dateline nearly 12 years earlier. They all continue to deny any involvement in the crime, and at the time of this episode's release, the lawsuit is still pending. But after 15 years, the murder of Lindsay Buziak continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So this has become one of the most heavily discussed unsolved cold cases in the history of Canada, and it's not hard to imagine why. Tragically, this is far from the only case you'll find in which a real estate agent was either murdered or went missing after arranging to show a house to a client. One of the most famous examples of this is the unsolved disappearance of real estate agent Susie Lamplaugh, which took place in the United Kingdom in 1986, and involved her disappearing after making an appointment to show a house to a man known only as Mr. Kipper, who likely lured her to that location in order to kill her. I know that in the past several years, attempts have been made to put additional safety precautions in place to protect real estate agents from situations like this, because being alone with a stranger in a vacant residence can put them in a very vulnerable position. But out of all the cold cases involving real estate agents, the murder of Lindsay Buziak might be the most bizarre and convoluted. It's pretty obvious that Lindsay was intentionally lured to the house showing at D'Souza Place for the express purpose of killing her, but this crime required a lot of pre-planning on the part of the perpetrators, and their potential motive is still up for debate. What further complicates this case is that the victim's boyfriend found her body and seemed to arrive at the scene at the exact moment that the killers were leaving, but there are a number of people who believe this is too convenient a coincidence. Now, given that we're a Canadian podcast, it's not too surprising that this has always been one of my most highly requested cases, and during the intro, I already outlined my reasons for covering it now. But even though I was already familiar with the details of the story, I had no idea that it was such a huge rabbit hole. It was not until I started doing research for this episode when I said to myself, what the hell have I got myself into? Quite frankly, this is an incredibly challenging cold case to analyze, particularly when it comes to trying to separate verified facts from rumors and hearsay. I've previously mentioned that this case has a lot of examples of contradictory information from different sources, and it's often hard to determine which details are verified facts and which are misinformation. Detective Sergeant Chris Horsley used to be the lead investigator for the Saanich PD until he retired last year, but here's a quote he made about Jeff Buziak during a 2018 article for CBC. Quote, "He's really forming his opinions based on things out there on social media, the internet, websites, and blogs that are putting things out there that, for the most part, simply aren't true. If we had the grounds to go forward, to seek charge approval from Crown Counsel, we certainly would have done so at this time." End quote. It's no big secret that the Saanich PD have never been big fans of Jeff's website, lindsaybuziakmurder.com, but in response, Jeff has stated in numerous interviews that most of the misinformation and false details you'll find out there about this case were originally shared by the police. I should mention that Canadian law enforcement has a tendency to hold back a lot more information about unsolved cold cases and active investigations from the public than American law enforcement. That also holds true for Lindsay Buziak's murder, but while there's a ton of information about the case on the internet, it can be tough to discern which details are verified facts that have been confirmed by law enforcement, and which of them are rumors that have spread so much that they are now accepted as fact. I will acknowledge that I can't say with 100% certainty that all the information shared in this episode is accurate, but I am trying to be as fair and objective as possible, and this is an unfortunate side effect of having all these different sides accusing the other of lying. Jeff Buziak is definitely one of the most passionate and relentless advocates I've ever seen for a murdered family member, and if you compare the interviews he gave on shows like Dateline over a decade ago to the interviews he has done in recent years, you can see him becoming progressively more frustrated with the police and their inability to solve this case. Jeff has frequently said that he is not going to go away until either this case is solved or he passes away, and I definitely believe him. But things have become a lot more complicated over the past year, since Shirley Zalo has decided to file a defamation lawsuit against Jeff and two of the commenters on his website. Ironically enough, when he was interviewed on True Crime Daily several years ago, Jeff mentioned that he received threats about lawsuits over his website on a constant basis, but at that point, no one had sued him yet. Since his current lawsuit is still up in the air, I'm obviously going to tread lightly when it comes to accusing anyone of murder on this podcast. However, here's what's always bothered me about this whole situation. I cannot think of another case where individuals have been publicly cleared as suspects by law enforcement, yet it still seemed that the vast majority of people continued to believe that they were guilty. If you search through online discussions, the general consensus still seems to be that Jason and Shirley Zalo were complicit in Lindsay's murder. Of course, Jeff Buziak's response would be that the only reason that the Zalos were cleared was because the Saanich PD were either incompetent or corrupt. It is true that Saanich is not an area which has had that many homicides, so the local police may have been out of their league investigating a crime like this. Shirley is known for being a wealthy, powerful, and influential individual in the Victoria area, and there have been numerous allegations that the Zalos have ties to drugs and criminal activity, or at the very least, associate themselves with known criminals. But would Shirley really have enough influence to curtail a murder investigation? Investigators originally announced that Jason had been cleared as a suspect about a year after the murder took place, but I find it interesting how they decided to make a public statement clearing Shirley and Ryan Zalo shortly after the Dateline episode about the case aired. Shirley would later state that even though Dateline filmed a lot of interview footage of her and Jason sharing their side of the story, the show only aired a small fraction of it in the finished episode, which is why many viewers still came away with the impression that they were involved in the crime. So it's almost like the Saanich PD made their statement in order to preemptively counter the response they were expecting to receive from those who believed that the Zalos were guilty. Now, obviously, even though Jason was the one who found Lindsay's body, I think even his biggest detractors would agree that he was not the one who personally killed her, as the timeline and the evidence seems to make that impossible. One theory which has been pushed forward is that the mysterious man and woman who met Lindsay for the house showing were Ryan and Shirley wearing a blonde wig in order to disguise herself, but I find that highly unlikely. According to the witnesses who saw this man and woman, they shook hands with Lindsay, and she didn't seem to know them, and I'm sure she would have recognized her boyfriend's mother and brother. No, the consensus seems to be that if the Zalos were complicit in the murder, they hired the unidentified man and woman to kill Lindsay on their behalf, and then orchestrated things so that Jason would have an alibi before he arrived at the crime scene. So this is why I'd like to hear the Saanich PD expand upon their reasons for clearing the Zalos as suspects. If by cleared, they're referring to them being the individuals who personally stabbed Lindsay to death, then yes, that decision was the correct one. But are they absolutely, positively, 100% certain that the family could not have hired someone else to commit this crime? Is there actual concrete proof that they could not have done this? Or have they just not found any evidence that a murder-for-hire plot took place? On one hand, the crime has all the hallmarks of a professional hit, which is why an alternate theory has been pushed forward that Lindsay's murder was somehow connected to a major drug trafficking operation and was killed because someone got the mistaken impression that she was a police informant. But on the other hand, stabbing someone over 40 times is a pretty brutal way to perform a hit. There is some logic in using a knife to kill Lindsay, since the house was located in a residential neighborhood, and a gunshot could have made enough noise to attract unwanted attention. However, stabbing an innocent young woman that many times seems like major overkill, and you get the sense that this was a very personal crime. Before we get into possible motives, I will say that the strongest piece of evidence which might point to the Zalos is the fact that Lindsay worked at Shirley's RE/MAX office, and the unidentified woman who called Lindsay's cell phone to inquire about buying a house seemed to have a lot of inside knowledge about real estate. The woman said that she needed to urgently purchase a home within the next 3 days, and was willing to spend as much as $1 million, which would have been a great boost for Lindsay's real estate career if she managed to make the sale. But if a client needed to arrange a purchase like that in such a short amount of time, you expect them to contact a more experienced and established real estate agent, but Lindsay seemed like an unusual choice since she had only been in the business for a few years. Now, the woman on the phone claimed that Lindsay had been recommended to her by a previous client, and most accounts state that when Lindsay attempted to contact this client to verify the story, they just happened to be out of town and were unreachable. In the real estate business, you would often refer to someone like that as a referral client And even if Lindsay hadn't been suspicious about the whole situation, she likely would have at least made a courtesy call to the referral client in order to thank them for the recommendation. But interestingly enough, according to the aforementioned 2020 article in the Capital Daily, there is no mention of this specific referral client in the original police documents. Instead, they say that Lindsay called some of her previous clients to ask if any of them had recommended her to the woman, but no one knew what she was talking about. This seems to be yet another issue with contradictory information, because I'd really like to know if the woman gave Lindsay the name of a specific previous client. If she did, then this suggests that the caller had inside knowledge of Lindsay's real estate dealings, and you have to wonder if they intentionally selected a client that they knew would be unavailable at that time, so Lindsay wouldn't be able to confirm the woman's story about a referral. I've heard Jeff imply in interviews that police have confirmed the identity of this so-called referral client and questioned them, but since they don't share much information with him, he has no idea what this person might have said. Now, another new detail in the Capital Daily article which took me by surprise is that on February the 1st, the day before she was killed, Lindsay emailed the woman a list of suggestions for homes in the Victoria area to look at. This is the first I've heard about Lindsay communicating with the buyers via email, but it's worth noting that prepaid burner phones do allow you to create throwaway email addresses. So even if police investigated the email address that this woman provided, I'm guessing that much like the cell phone, it was not used for any additional activity besides communicating with Lindsay. Even though the woman said she needed to purchase the home in a hurry, she still provided a specific list of requirements, including 3 bedrooms, 3 bathrooms, and an area for a live-in maid. The residents at 1702 D'Souza Place met all these requirements, which has led to more speculation that the killers may have had inside knowledge of all the houses which were listed at the RE/MAX Camison office, and that if they provided Lindsay with a specific criteria for homes to search for, she would choose this particular location. Of course, if you were planning a professional hit, you'd think that the killers would have asked Lindsay to show them some remote house in the country rather than a residence in a suburban neighborhood with a number of potential witnesses around. After all, there were witnesses who saw a man and woman arriving at the house to meet Lindsay. But D'Souza Place was located on a cul-de-sac which was still under construction at the time, so I don't believe there were many people living on that particular street. I don't know if this has any significance, but D'Souza Place was named after a prominent local developer named Joe D'Souza, who also happened to be a close friend and business associate of Shirley Zalo. On the day of the murder, D'Souza was actually present at the cul-de-sac supervising the construction crew, and they all left between 4:30 and 5 p.m., less than an hour before Lindsay arrived. I mean, it might be nothing more than a coincidence, but it is interesting how this crime took place at a location linked to someone who had close ties with the Zalo family. So even though Lindsay had 11 calls with the buyers, we really don't know anything about the content of their conversations, aside from the fact that the woman apparently spoke with a Spanish or Mexican accent. It's been reported that Lindsay believed that the accent might be fake, which could be supported by the fact that the man and woman seen with her at the house showing were described as being Caucasian. It is odd that Lindsay never wrote down the names of these clients or even shared them with her friends or family, but chances are that if they did provide Lindsay with names, they were probably false anyway, much like when the name Paulo Rodriguez was used to register the cell phone. It's obvious that Lindsay was torn between her concerns about the situation and the fact that she could potentially make a huge commission on a sale if these buyers were legitimate. But a detail which seems to be a source of controversy is when exactly Jason made the decision to stop by the house in order to keep an eye on Lindsay. The accounts I've heard from Lindsay's family and friends make it sound like she made this arrangement with Jason at least a day in advance, but the Capital Daily article, which is based on the original police reports, tells a different version of events. They say that Jason's original plan to quell Lindsay's concerns was to do the showing on her behalf, but Lindsay turned him down because she wanted to make the sale on her own. One of the reasons many people are so suspicious of Jason, because even though he was supposedly concerned enough about Lindsay to stop by the house and keep an eye on her, he wound up arriving there 15 minutes late, and by that point, she was likely already dead. But the way the article tells it, when Jason and Lindsay went out for lunch on the afternoon of February the 2nd, they had not made any arrangements for Jason to visit the residence when they parted ways. After that, Jason said he went to SHC Autographs to assist them with a real estate deal, and Lindsay called him on his cell phone while he was there. According to Jason, it was only then when he proposed the idea of going to the showing to keep an eye on Lindsay, as he needed to stop by there anyway in order to give Lindsay some paperwork he had received from the auto shop owners. If this information is accurate, then this suggests that Jason's decision to drive to D'Souza Place was made at the very last minute, so him arriving late does not seem as suspicious. And it would also go against the idea of this pre-planned scenario where Jason intentionally arrives at the murder only minutes after Lindsay was killed in order to discover her body. All that being said, even though this new information I shared came from the original police reports, I would not say it completely clears Jason of any suspicion. We technically only have his word that these events unfolded this way, as Lindsay is obviously not around to confirm them. Unless investigators found other corroborating evidence to back up Jason's claims, such as texts and emails where Jason and Lindsay were outlining their plans, then I would take everything he says with a grain of salt. But I also acknowledge that law enforcement has access to a lot more information than we do, and they may have had their reasons for deciding to clear Jason as a suspect. Anyway, when Jason finally arrived in the cul-de-sac at D'Souza Place, he elected not to go inside the house, and instead pulled his Range Rover onto an adjacent street, because he didn't want to come across as a quote-unquote meddling boyfriend. He only decided to enter the residence several minutes later, because Lindsay didn't respond to his texts. Since Jason supposedly wanted to keep an eye on Lindsay, it might seem odd that he would hang around outside for so long without confirming she was okay, and it's also a convenient coincidence that he just happened to do this during the time period where the killers were fleeing the house. You can definitely interpret these actions in different ways, depending on whether you believe Jason is innocent or guilty. If Jason is innocent and being truthful about everything, he was under the impression that Lindsay was giving a tour inside the house, and she had established that she wanted to do it on her own. As someone who worked in real estate himself, Jason may have thought it would come off as unprofessional if he walked inside to check on Lindsay and potentially jeopardized her sale, so that's why he elected to stay parked outside. But if Jason is guilty and hired these individuals to kill Lindsay, then he may have been taken by surprise when he arrived and saw them at the front door, so he parked on the adjacent street to give them an opportunity to escape. That sort of thing may not have mattered if Jason was alone, but since Cohen Oatman, an impartial witness, was there, Jason may have wanted to prevent Cohen from getting a good look at the perpetrators. After all, if they stabbed Lindsay over 40 times, there's a good chance they would have had blood on their clothing, which would have captured Cohen's attention and possibly compelled him to intervene. Unfortunately, we've run into the same issue with contradictory information about this situation from different sources, as for years, it was reported that Jason had only seen the outline of a male figure behind the smoked glass on the front door. I believe the True Crime Daily episode, which came out in 2017, was the first outlet to report that the killers had literally stepped out the front door for a few seconds before they ducked back inside. And this information was literally shared on camera by lead investigator Chris Horsley. Well, even if this version of events is correct, Jason claimed that he did not initially find it suspicious because he simply believed these people were the clients who were there for the showing. Now, those who believe Jason was involved in the murder have theorized that his sole purpose for bringing Cohen to the house is because he wanted a witness present when he found Lindsay's body who would back up his story that he was elsewhere when the murder took place. Apparently, it might be a bit of an exaggeration to refer to Jason and Cohen as friends, as some sources state that while they were co-workers, they did not have a close relationship, and Cohen was taken by surprise when Jason invited him out to dinner that night. Cohen was probably not expecting this side trip to D'Souza Place, so it's possible that Jason contacted him for the sole purpose of arranging an alibi witness. After all, it is a bit weird that Jason would be planning to go out for dinner with Cohen almost immediately after he had a late lunch with Lindsay, which ended at around 4:30 p.m. Police never gave any indication that they considered Cohen to be a suspect, And as far as I can tell, he has never spoken to the media, so I have no idea what Cohen's personal thoughts are about the whole situation. Another point which has been made to cast suspicion on Jason is that when Cohen led him into the house, Jason immediately rushed upstairs to the master bedroom to search for Lindsay without checking anywhere on the ground floor. This could mean that he already knew that Lindsay's body was upstairs, but to play devil's advocate, since Cohen had entered through the back door and didn't see anything, maybe Jason automatically assumed that Lindsay was not down there. There were apparently bloody footprints in the house, and while it's never been specified where, if these bloody footprints were on the stairs and Jason saw them, then it makes sense that he would instantly head towards the bedroom. So one of the big unanswered questions in this case is whether any unidentified DNA was found at the scene. The Saanich PD have made conflicting statements about this, but in 2021, they did specifically say that DNA analysis has helped create some new leads in this case, though they provided no further details. Even though law enforcement described Jason as being very cooperative with the investigation, you will find a number of sources out there which state that he refused to provide them with a sample of his own DNA, though I have to add the disclaimer that the police themselves have never publicly confirmed this. Regardless, even if the police had Jason's DNA, I'm not sure it would prove or disprove anything. By his own admission, Jason touched Lindsay's body and attempted to give her CPR before the paramedics arrived, so his DNA is obviously going to be at the murder scene. I do have a hard time believing that absolutely no DNA was left behind by the perpetrators, considering the amount of times that Lindsay was stabbed. Even if Jason was complicit in Lindsay's murder, or knows more than he's letting on, I think it's pretty obvious that he was not the one who actually killed her, though I've always wondered how people would view this case had the eyewitness not reported seeing Lindsay meeting a man and a blonde woman outside the house. It is a bit odd that the woman was described as wearing a distinct black dress patterned with white and red swirls, as why would you wear such a memorable piece of clothing to a murder? But then again, the dress was so distinct that perhaps the woman felt that if any witnesses saw her, they would be so focused on the dress that they wouldn't get a good look at her face. The eyewitness sightings pretty much established that these two people have to be the killers, but neither Jason or any of the witnesses reported seeing any vehicles at the scene besides Lindsay's BMW. I mean, I guess it's possible that they could have taken a cab to the house, but that leaves a huge risk of them being identified by the driver, and I'm sure they would not have wanted to hail a cab to leave the scene if they had Lindsay's blood on their clothing. So the most logical explanation is that in order to prevent their vehicle from being identified, they parked on another nearby street and walked to the house, and subsequently ran back to their parked vehicle when they fled. However, even though Jason drove out of the cul-de-sac after he first arrived at the house and parked for about 10 minutes on the adjacent Torquay Drive, I've seen no indication that he reported seeing any other parked vehicles on that street, which may have belonged to the killers. According to cell tower ping records, it seems like the perpetrators traveled from Vancouver to Victoria on a ferry, and since you can park your cars on ferries, they would have been able to use their own vehicle to make the trip. While we're on the subject of this burner phone, the following detail has never been officially confirmed by law enforcement, but Jeff Buziak has claimed that after its owners arrived in Victoria, the phone pinged off some cell towers, which were very close to the residence of a man named Edgar Ovidio Acevedo, who went by the nickname Vid. I'll go into more detail about him later on, but Vid was known for being a major drug dealer in the area with an extensive criminal record, and he also happened to be friends with Jason. And according to Jeff, when he returned to Saanich in 2016 to do his annual walk for justice on the 8-year anniversary of Lindsay's murder, he had a public run-in with Vid and was threatened by him. This led to police being summoned to the scene, but the situation was resolved and no arrests were made. But before we talk about this whole drug angle surrounding the crime, we have to discuss other potential motives. It was mentioned in the Dateline episode that Lindsay had talked about breaking up with Jason, though he denied this during his interview and said that there were not any serious problems in the relationship. However, Lindsay's best friend, Nikki Burrows, once shared a story which contradicts this. Nikki claims that sometime in December of 2007, they both returned to Lindsay's condo after a night out, and Lindsay discussed her plans to end her relationship with Jason. They assumed that Jason was sleeping at the time, but it turned out that he was listening to their conversation from another room, and once Lindsay and Nikki saw him, they ran out of the condo. Jason then proceeded to call Lindsay's cell phone several times before she returned home, and apparently, Jason just acted like the conversation about the breakup never happened. But in spite of this, it sounds like Jason treated Lindsay very well during their Christmas ski trip, and she did have a good time, so she was softening up on the idea of ending things with him. Of course, since stabbing a victim over 40 times sounds like a rage killing, I could see someone who felt wronged by their spouse deciding to do something like that. If the detail about Lindsay being stabbed several times in her newly augmented breasts is true, then that's another detail which points to this crime being personal. But even though there are plenty of men who have murdered their spouses for breaking up or attempting to break up with them, it seems like an awful lot of trouble to orchestrate a convoluted murder for hire, which involves arranging for two people from another city to lure Lindsay to a fake house showing in order to kill her. There's been speculation that Shirley was the mastermind behind this whole plot, but hiring someone to murder your son's spouse because she may have been planning to break up with him sounds like a very extreme reaction. Now, the Dateline episode also discussed Lindsay's former boyfriend, Matt McDuff, who has never been considered a suspect and seems to have a very solid alibi clearing him of any involvement. During Shirley's interview on the show, she discussed a conversation that she claimed she had with Lindsay on the night before she was killed, where Lindsay mentioned being afraid of Matt, but I'm very skeptical of this story. It is true that Lindsay and Matt had some rough patches during their relationship, as she called the police on him three separate times, though no criminal charges were ever filed. But at the time of Lindsay's murder, she had not communicated with Matt for months, and he had moved on and was in a serious relationship with another woman. I see no reason for Lindsay to suddenly tell Shirley that she was fearful of Matt, so it almost sounds like Shirley might have fabricated the story in order to deflect suspicion away from Jason. It's worth mentioning that Matt got pretty emotional during his Dateline interview and seemed to be devastated by Lindsay's murder, but a number of people, including Jeff Buziak, have pointed out that they never saw Jason shed one tear or get emotional at all about losing Lindsay, even though he had to go through the traumatic experience of finding her body. I mean, I know it's common practice to become suspicious of victims' loved ones when they don't express much emotion over their deaths, but different people react to trauma in different ways, so I would say that's a clear-cut indicator of Jason's guilt. So getting back to Shirley, if she was the one who orchestrated this whole murder-for-hire plot, it may have had nothing to do with Lindsay's relationship issues with her son, but rather because Lindsay discovered something she wasn't supposed to, such as evidence that Shirley was involved in illegal activities. As far as I can tell, Shirley has never been arrested for any crime, but going through online discussions about this case, she's painted as this very powerful figure who associates with criminals and has enough influence to prevent the police from solving this murder. There have been rumors that Jason has been involved in drugs and criminal activity, and he was definitely friends with some sketchy characters with criminal histories. One individual who is often brought up in relation to this case is a guy named Zachary Scott Matheson, who went by the nickname Ziggy, and has a lengthy criminal record for drug and violence-related offenses. In fact, in February of 2000, Ziggy was charged with second-degree murder and assault after he was accused of beating his ex-girlfriend Shannon Spruit with the butt end of a gun, while an associate of his named David Niebergall fatally shot Shannon's new boyfriend Kevin Black right in front of her. Even though Niebergall pled guilty to the murder and went to prison, the charges against Ziggy were stayed because Shannon died of an overdose the following year. Well, Ziggy would be arrested on drug charges in 2013, and at the time, he was living at a rental house which was owned by Shirley. Following the arrest, Shirley made a public statement that her family had no connection to the man who had been living in her house, but in actuality, Ziggy was good friends with Jason and Ryan, and they often hung out with them at his residence. In fact, Ziggy was supposedly present on the ski trip that Lindsay took with the Zalos around Christmas of 2007, so she definitely knew him as well. Now, I'm not trying to imply that Ziggy was personally involved in Lindsay's murder, but since he was friends with the Zalo family, This has continued to fuel rumors that the Zalos were involved in their own criminal activities and would have had the resources to bring in outsiders to kill Lindsay. In fact, one unverified theory that I've often seen spread online is that Shirley was using her real estate business to launder money for drug dealers like Ziggy, and Lindsay may have found out about it. I really don't know what to make of the information shared in the Capital Daily article about the possibility that some messages which were left on Lindsay's Facebook wall in the week prior to her death might have been deleted. I'm not sure if the implication is that Lindsay herself deleted them, or if Jason might have done it, as he lived with her and had access to her laptop, which he turned over to the police following the murder. So was there some incriminating information posted on Facebook that Jason didn't want the authorities to see? Well, now we have to talk about this drug bust which took place in Calgary and the theories that this somehow played a role in Lindsay's murder. It was part of an ongoing investigation titled Operation High Noon, but it should be clarified that the major drug bust itself did not actually take place until June of 2009, 1 year after Lindsay was killed. The whole thing seemed to be set in motion when Erickson, Lopez, Del Alcazar, and another associate, who were both part of this big drug trafficking network, were arrested on January the 22nd, 2008. This was only 11 days before Lindsay's murder, and since she had recently made a trip to Calgary and attempted to reconnect with an old friend who was Del Alcazar's relative, this has fueled rumors that Lindsay may have learned incriminating information about this drug network and was murdered because she was a police informant. While law enforcement has continually denied that Lindsay was an informant or had any involvement in drugs or illegal activity, Lindsay's family and friends have constantly stated that she personally disliked drugs and had no interest in them, but nonetheless, if someone was under the mistaken impression that she was an informant and had ratted out Del Alcazar to the police, they may have arranged to have her killed. If you visit the Lindsay Buziak murder website, you'll find a section titled The Conspirators, which features the names, photos, and addresses of known criminals who were allegedly involved in Lindsay's death. I won't share most of their names here, but the list includes Erickson Lopez Del Alcazar, a number of his relatives, and Edgar Vid Acevedo, whom I mentioned earlier. Admittedly, the link between Lindsay and Del Alcazar is a very thin one, and even though Lindsay did go out with people while she was in Calgary, it's unclear if she actually saw Del Alcazar's relative or Del Alcazar himself. Even so, I'm not sure how much incriminating information Lindsay could have learned about drug trafficking to put her life at risk. The Saanich PD have stated that they do not believe the Calgary drug bust had any connection to Lindsay's murder, and here's one of my biggest issues with that. The burner phone the killers used to communicate with Lindsay was purchased in Vancouver in late November of 2007, which is around the approximate time period that Operation High Noon was launched. But Lindsay didn't even travel to Calgary until mid-December, and Del Alcazar's arrest did not take place until January. Why would anyone be buying a burner phone to be used in the commission of a murder plot when the intended victim hadn't even done anything to make them a target in the first place? Regardless of who was responsible for this crime, it's always bothered me that this phone was purchased 2 months before Lindsay's murder, because who could have held such a grudge against her to plan this so far in advance? I guess the alternate explanation is that career criminals use burner phones all the time in order to conduct their activities, and will often keep a bunch of them on hand. So when this particular burner phone was purchased in late November, the buyer did not yet know how it was going to be used. It was not actually activated until January the 31st, which was 2 days before Lindsay's murder, and the same day she received her first call from the mysterious woman. I'm guessing a decision had been made that this phone would be used for the express purpose of communicating with Lindsay and luring her to her death, and then they would get rid of it afterward. I mentioned earlier that when the owners of this cell phone traveled from Vancouver to Victoria, ping records supposedly placed the phone near the residence of another career criminal named Vid Acevedo, which was located not too far from D'Souza Place. If this is accurate, then this implies that Vid provided the killers with a place to stay when they arrived in Victoria, meaning that he was complicit in the murder. Now, I'll add the disclaimer that Vid's alleged involvement in this crime has never been reported on by law enforcement or the media, and is just one of many details you'll find exclusively in interviews with Jeff Buziak, as well as his Lindsay Buziak Murder website and other assorted blogs and websites about the case. I won't mention this person's name, but you'll also find discussion online about another employee from the Remax Camison office who was supposedly involved in a relationship with Vid during this time period. This employee apparently quit her job at Remax the day after Lindsay was killed and would have been privy to information about real estate listings if the murder was an elaborate setup. But another rumor is that she quit because she was afraid of the Zalos. The internet just contains so many conspiracy theories and unverified rumors and hearsay about this case, and I've elected not to mention many of them during this episode because I just don't know how truthful they are. However, there is one odd story I want to address here because it is listed on Lindsay Buziak's Wikipedia page. It involves Lindsay's friend, Nikki Burrows, as sometime in 2008, she was supposedly woken up in the middle of the night by a phone call which was made by a woman from a number that Nikki did not recognize. Since Nikki was still half asleep, she did not pay much attention to what the caller was saying, but noticed that they were speaking in an odd accent, which Nikki thought sounded fake. After the call ended, Nikki tried calling the number back about 20 to 30 times without any answer, but a woman did eventually pick up, and it turned out to be Shirley Zalo. Nikki wondered why Shirley would be calling her, since they did not personally know each other, but Shirley's explanation was that she had a secretary named Nikki and had actually intended to call her. Since Nikki did know Jason, Shirley believed that he may have added Nikki's name and number to her contact list, which is why she mistakenly called the wrong Nikki. It's been reported that Shirley denied that this call ever happened, but unfortunately, there's never been any further follow-up on this story. It's never been mentioned by law enforcement or reported on by any media outlet, and Nikki has never publicly spoken about it either. The source which is cited for this claim on the Wikipedia page is an episode of the Case File podcast which was produced about this case in 2016, and Jeff Buziak has shared this story in interviews. Due to the lack of any further information about this, I am taking the whole story with a huge grain of salt, but if by chance it is true, it would paint a pretty damning picture of Shirley. Her explanation about accidentally phoning the wrong Nikki doesn't hold water, because why would she be speaking to her secretary in a fake Spanish accent? But on the other hand, what possible reason could Shirley have for making a call like this to Nikki Burrows in the first place? What was she trying to accomplish? I guess if Shirley was involved in Lindsay's murder and felt that Nikki might be asking too many questions, she could have phoned Nikki in the middle of the night to intimidate her and use the Spanish accent to give off the impression that the same woman who had phoned Lindsay was coming after Nikki next. However, why would Shirley make a call like this from her own phone number and then answer when Nikki called her back? We're talking about a murder plot where the perpetrator used a disposable burner phone to communicate with Lindsay, so Shirley would have known the importance of not using your own phone for this sort of thing. So back in 2019, True Crime Garage released a two-part podcast episode on this case, and it's one of the few pieces of media I've seen which did not automatically cast the Zalo family in a suspicious light. This is likely due to the fact that as part of their research, they consulted with a man named Gary Rogers, a retired Royal Canadian Mounted Police serious crimes detective and investigator with the British Columbia Coroner Service, who has since become a true crime author. At the time, Rogers was working on a book about this case, but if you visit his personal blog, it seems like he has put the project on hold because the story became a much bigger rabbit hole than he was expecting, and he fears that publishing the book could compromise an active police investigation. Well, long story short, Rogers also posted that he does not believe the Zalos were involved in Lindsay's murder and thinks she was a completely innocent victim of a conspiracy to frame her as a police informant. This may have been done for the purpose of protecting a real informant who had connections to the Sinaloa cartel, which is the most powerful drug cartel in Mexico. I won't reveal their names, but Rogers believes that the man and woman hired to kill Lindsay were a Mexican brother and sister who have since left Canada, though the individuals responsible for setting all this up apparently still live in the Victoria area. Okay. So a theory involving the Sinaloa cartel sounds really over the top, but they did operate in Canada during that time period. The cartel's former leader was Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, who was extradited to the U.S. and went to prison 4 years ago, but during his trial, an undercover DEA agent testified that the Sinaloa cartel liked to target Canada because of its weak national policing, and at one point, they were making almost $3 million per day by selling cocaine and heroin in major Canadian cities. But again, what could possibly compel such a major drug cartel to orchestrate a professional hit on someone like Lindsay Buziak? They must have been fed some serious misinformation if they believed that Lindsay, a 24-year-old real estate agent with no criminal record, was a police informant who had enough intel about their operation to cause them serious damage. I can believe that after Erickson Lopez del Alcazar was arrested, other members of his drug trafficking network would work diligently to uncover who ratted him out and may have been inclined to kill someone if they wanted to encourage others from speaking to the police. But I still don't see how we get to the point where a pair of killers are hired to travel to Victoria for the express purpose of taking Lindsay out. I really do hope that the book Gary Rogers was working on comes out someday, because I would love to learn more details about how he arrived at the conclusion that the Sinaloa cartel were involved. So whether you believe the Zalos were responsible for Lindsay's murder, or the crime was connected to drug trafficking, or she was killed because she saw or heard something she wasn't supposed to, I do not believe there is any theory surrounding this crime which makes 100% complete sense. I've even tried to think outside the box and come up with alternate theories which haven't been discussed yet, but since nothing was stolen from Lindsay and she was not sexually assaulted, what other motives could there be for this crime? Part of me wonders if this was a random thrill kill, as perhaps someone saw Lindsay's photo on a real estate brochure somewhere and thought she would be an ideal target. That sort of theory might seem unlikely, but it's not unprecedented for real estate agents to be victims of crimes like this. As an example, Unsolved Mysteries once produced a segment about the 2001 murder of a real estate agent named Mike Emmert, who was stabbed 19 times while showing a house in Seattle, Washington, to a prospective client known only as Steven. Years later, DNA evidence would link a suspect named Gary Krueger to the crime, as well as the murders of at least three other men, but since Krueger drowned a few months before the DNA match was made, we will probably never know his motive for killing Mike Emmert. Investigators considered the possibility of a murder-for-hire plot, but never found anything in Mike's background to suggest he had any serious enemies or was involved in something that could compel someone to kill him. What's particularly bizarre is that Mike had told people that the mysterious Steven carried a cane and walked with a limp, but it now appears that this was all a ruse, and the cane may have been concealing the knife used to stab Mike. This was such a meticulously planned crime, but why would Gary Krueger go to all this trouble to murder someone he likely didn't even know? Well, it's possible that the whole thing was nothing more than a thrill kill, and Krueger went to the trouble of meeting a real estate agent for a house showing and murdering him just because he could. I've never seen this theory proposed in Lindsay Buziak's case, and I'm definitely not going to say this is what happened, as I'm not sure a random thrill killer would go to the trouble of purchasing a burner phone and taking a ferry ride to another city just for the purpose of killing a stranger. But after 15 years of conspiracy theories, finger-pointing, and rumors about drug trafficking, it would certainly be crazy if all these scenarios turned out to be red herrings, and the man and woman who killed Lindsay have never popped up on the radar as potential suspects because they targeted her at random. I would love to give my own personal thoughts about what I believe happened to Lindsay, but overall, I can honestly say that I really don't know what to make of this one, and it's hard to form a concrete theory about what happened. Now, the primary theory you'll find in this case is that Jason and Shirley Zalo were responsible for orchestrating Lindsay's murder, and while I do still have my suspicions about them, I cannot overlook the fact that the entire family has been publicly cleared as suspects by law enforcement. Yes, law enforcement is not infallible, and they have faced a ton of criticism for how they handled this investigation, so perhaps they made the wrong decision here. It's also possible that the truth lies somewhere in the middle, as the Zalos may not have had direct involvement in the crime, but have still not been forthcoming about everything they know, as they may have their own skeletons in the closet, such as involvement in illegal activity. But Shirley's decision to file a defamation lawsuit last year against Jeff Buziak and his website has made this case even more complicated. Regardless of whether or not you believe Shirley's actions are justified, if she's actually guilty of involvement in this murder, she would be taking a huge risk here, as she could potentially be required to give a sworn deposition and answer questions under oath she may not want to be asked. Only time will tell how this lawsuit ultimately turns out, but it will be interesting to see if this leads to any new information coming out. I am inclined to believe that the drug bust in Calgary has no real connection to Lindsay's murder, but it's apparent that some people believe that the crime is drug-related in some way, and Lindsay may have been killed for reasons which had nothing to do with her. If the Saanich PD are covering something up, or attempting to sandbag the investigation, then at least we can rely on Jeff to continue keeping his daughter's case in the spotlight. Remember, this is not one of those cases where a victim's death was ruled to be a suicide or an accident, and their family is clinging to the idea that foul play took place. Lindsay was most definitely the victim of a brutal murder, and her loved ones have every right to be angry and keep shouting from the rooftops until this crime is solved. This case is definitely not just going away, and for all we know, all we might need is for the right person to come forward. So if you happen to have any information about the murder of Lindsay Buziak, please contact the Saanich Police Department at 250-475-4356. That's 250-475-4356. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Melissa Holman for narrating the opening of this week's episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. Once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, we released a bonus episode about a fraud case from Unsolved Mysteries involving a man named Woody Kelly, who embezzled millions of dollars before he vanished without a trace, and he has not been seen for nearly 38 years. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1992 murder of Heather Uffelman by an unidentified suspect known only as Tom Johnson. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Heather S., Catherine, and Angela O. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another true crime podcast, Murder, She Told.
Growing up as a latchkey kid in a small town in Maine, I always assumed I was safe. After all, unless it made national news, murder wasn't something people talked about around here. But that doesn't mean it didn't happen. Murder, She Told is an award-winning true crime podcast that dives into the lesser-known cold cases and true crime stories from Maine, New England, and beyond, created by me, Kristen Zeevy, a victim's advocate. Murder, She Told uses detailed storytelling with an investigative twist, weaving in original interviews with those closest to the case, rooted in deep research, straightforward narratives, and the victims and their family at the center of every story. Murder, She Told will speak to any listener, no matter where they call home. Learn more at murdershetold.com or find Murder, She Told now wherever you get podcasts.
I also just wanted to mention that The Trail Went Cold will be in attendance at two separate CrimeCon events that are taking place in 2023. The first one is CrimeCon UK, which is returning to London, and will be held at the Tower Bridge Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa on June the 10th and 11th. And 2 months after that, I'll be attending the regular CrimeCon event, which will be held from September the 22nd to the 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code which can be used to get a special 10% discount on tickets, and this time around, the same code is valid for both events. So in order to purchase tickets and get a 10% discount, you can either visit crimecon.co.uk or crimecon.com and use the special promo code COLE23. That's COLE23. Just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.